So our kids think that that's the answer. Like if a pill fixes mom and dad and grandma and grandpa, then, well, it should be okay. It's a prescription. It should be fine. And that's the unfortunate place that we're at in society. We've just been bred that there's an answer to that in a pill.
Dr. James Bogash wants people to understand the consequences when drugs dominate and lifestyle is pushed to the side. He's our guest on this episode of Win This Year.
Drugs and alcohol.
Bullying.
Unhealthy relationships.
Depression.
Internet safety.
Substance use.
Body image.
Self-injury.
Suicide.
Anxiety.
Social media.
Kids.
Preteens.
Parenting.
Middle school.
High school.
Adolescents.
Teens.
Coping skills.
Self-care.
Relationships.
Strategies.
Life skills.
Prevention.
Solutions.
Help.
Hope.
Leadership.
Insight.
Information.
Inspiration.
You're listening to Win This Year, the official podcast of Not My Kid, a prevention nonprofit focused on inspiring positive life choices by helping kids, parents, families, and those who work with youth. Informative, interesting, inspiring. Win This Year.
Welcome to Win This Year. I'm Shane Watson, Public Information Officer and Prevention Specialist for Not My Kid. Our guest today is Dr. James Bogash. Dr. Bogash was raised in the frigid suburbs of Chicago and graduated with his bachelor's degree in biology from the University of Illinois at Chicago. After working 3 years, he went back to school and ultimately graduated from National University of Health Sciences with a Doctor of Chiropractic degree in 1997, moving out to Arizona in the spring of 1998. He opened Life Care Chiropractic in March of 1998 and has been actively involved in serving and educating the community ever since. Dr. Bogash stays current with new research, reading in excess of 120 peer-reviewed medical journals per month. He uses his knowledge of physiology combined with new research to educate patients on the best methods to avoid or manage chronic disease, and his 10-week lifestyle management class is one of the most comprehensive programs available to teach patients everything they need to know to make positive lifestyle changes. Because of this passion for knowledge, helping patients, and clarifying tough health issues, he has become a sought-after lecturer. He now joins us on Win This Year. Dr. Bogash, welcome to Win This Year.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on, Shane.
You went back to school in 1997 to get your Doctor of Chiropractic degree. Why did you decide to do that? What inspired or motivated you to make that choice?
I had my bachelor's degree and I was working in the field of biology, and anybody's had gotten a degree in biology, it's a great starter, but it's not the end point. And I just realized that I really wanted to do more. So that's why I ended up going back to school. And in hindsight, I wouldn't change a thing of where I'm at. I mean, maybe be a fighter pilot, but nobody's shooting at me now. So there's certain advantages there.
What's been the most rewarding part of working in the field you chose? What do you appreciate most about being a chiropractor?
You know, what's really interesting is as a chiropractor, now we practice quite a bit different in that we certainly adjust, but a huge chunk of what we do is soft tissues. So muscles, ligaments, tendons, fascia, stretching. So a typical visit with me hands-on is about 10 to 15 minutes. That gives me a lot of time to talk to people about what they're having for breakfast, about their family history, concerns, risk of chronic disease. And the problem with educating people about taking better care of themselves is that there's not a lot of money to be made in that. There certainly are niches there that you can fit into, but I'm in a practice where I get a lot of time talking to patients and I can start to educate them about taking better care of themselves. And that's the perfect scenario of where I ended up. And it makes when I have patients who, there's the musculoskeletal side of the practice. So I had a patient yesterday that was in agony, could hardly move. We didn't do a whole lot for him yesterday, but I saw him today and he's already doing not 100% better, but definitely better. And being able to have relatively quick changes in somebody's pain level, really rewarding. And then long-term, helping them understand how some of their choices are leading to, whether it's high blood pressure, obesity, or cardiovascular disease, being able to help them with that. And when people see the light and make changes, that's like the best. To be a part of that is really a rewarding part of the practice.
So it sounds like beyond the adjustments themselves, as we said in your intro, when it comes to lifestyle changes, you're helping that person identify areas where they could improve their lifestyle and therefore improve their overall health physically, mentally, emotionally, et cetera.
Absolutely. That's a huge, but that's all part of it. I mean, if you're in pain, you're not moving. If you're not moving, you're not feeling your best. If you're not making the right dietary, like everything all goes together. I mean, if you want to have, you can't be a couch potato and have, you know, the best lifestyle if you're a couch potato. Your movement has to be a part of that. And exercise alone is not the answer to the question, because there's lots of people who exercise and still have chronic diseases because of the choices they're making. It's all part of the package of taking better care of yourself.
Are there things that you feel that some in the general public misunderstand about chiropractic care? And if so, what are they?
Well, certainly for me, and I am pretty active on social media, and I hear this a lot where, you know, we shouldn't take advice from a chiropractor on how to improve, lower your cholesterol. And I always say it's funny that human physiology acts differently depending upon the letters after your name, which obviously is not true. So there's definitely a misunderstanding of how much background education we get and knowledge of physiology and human health, whether somebody who graduates from chiropractic school takes that and runs with it. Different story, but certainly the background is there to understand all of the complex health issues that we're dealing with in today's society.
What are the biggest benefits to chiropractic care, including perhaps some of the ones that maybe people might not even realize? Obviously, reducing pain is a huge one. I think a lot of people are aware of that. Are there other benefits that maybe people aren't even aware of when it comes to getting chiropractic care?
Now, I don't necessarily like you wouldn't hear somebody coming in my office with childhood ear infections or enuresis or nighttime bedwetting or high blood pressure or anything. But when we're moving around, we feel better. And it also means that patients in my office, we're having an interaction. If they go from being in intense pain to feeling much better in a short period of time, then they're also going to be more open to listening to what I might have to say about what they're having for breakfast or not having breakfast. And so overall, seeing a chiropractor that understands all how much lifestyle plays a role in that, it's going to have benefits cutting across. Quite frankly, most people come into my office for musculoskeletal. They're in pain for some reason, whatever it is. It's chronic, it's acute, they're in pain. And when they leave here, the hopes are that not only is the pain improved, better, or gone, but they now understand how some of the choices that they're making are impacting their overall health. So, you know, my biased opinion is that we should be the first stop for any type of pain condition. And of course, it's not just my biased opinion. The research strongly suggests that chiropractic care as a first portal of entry for specific, the research is done specifically in spinal conditions, but or back pain, but there's a lot of different conditions, knee pain, things like that, that are well served by seeing a chiropractor first. I mean, there's times I can't manage somebody's problem, and in which case I will get them out to the appropriate provider that I have a good relationship with that I know is going to take care of the patient.
It sounds like more than just treating them as a patient or addressing their one particular issue, I really appreciate and respect the fact that it's clear that you're viewing them as an entire human being. And while you've got that time with them, and you answered this in the first question I asked you, you are looking at what other areas can I benefit this person? And that's such a great thing in an era where I feel like some people going to certain medical practices feel as if they're being treated as a number. It's clear that with you, you are treating the individual as a whole human being, which leads me to my next question. Who in particular can benefit from seeing a chiropractor? Now, some of that's obvious. You've answered some certain conditions that people have, and their first thought is going to a chiropractor. But who in particular, beyond maybe the obvious answers, could benefit from going and getting care from someone like you?
Well, I already mentioned that anybody in acute or even chronic pain can benefit from the care of a good chiropractor. We don't often see people who just come in and say, listen, I just want to be stretched out. I just want to feel better. Our bodies are designed to move. And a perfect example, I have she's since passed, but I had a patient, Rose was her name. She was in her mid-80s, and she'd come in, and I didn't do a whole lot. We did some soft tissue work. I did some stretching. I did some adjusting. And she would leave here thinking I was a miracle worker, and I wasn't. I was just moving her body where she, unfortunately, was not doing. She wasn't active. Mm-hmm. But movement itself, our bodies like to move. And that has a positive mental impact on it. And it's like hopping in the pool and swimming. Like, it just feels good to move. And that has an overall impact on the mental, on depression, on anxiety. Any type of psychological problem is going to feel better when we're moving. And from a chiropractor, all we're doing is helping your body move in those positions. We're doing it locally here, and then that is best augmented or helped by somebody then moving out of the office. I just tell my patients that the more you do out there, the less you'll need me in here.
Absolutely. One of the reasons why I wanted to have you as a guest on the show is to talk about the power of chiropractic care as an alternative to opioids when treating pain, with a special focus on youth. We've had multiple guests on the show whose lives were significantly negatively impacted by opioids, including multiple individuals, guests on the show who were addicted, or individuals who lost their own children to an opioid overdose. One of your blog entries is entitled, Drugging Our Children, Five Scary Findings. And I'd like to share a few statistics you mentioned in that blog post to set the tone for my next questions. And these are from JAMA Pediatrics, which is the Pediatric Journal of the American Medical Association. 17.6% of high school seniors reported medical use, so that was prescribed, of prescription opioids. Meanwhile, 12.9% reported non-medical use, meaning they were using them recreationally to try to get a high. More than 37% of non-medical users used intranasal administration, which means they are crushing up and snorting the pills, which often circumvents a time release mechanism and gets it in the bloodstream practically pretty much immediately. And then 80% of non-medical users with an earlier history of medical use had obtained prescription opioids from a prescription they had previously. So what was initially medical use through that prescription turned into non-medical use. And then the final stat here, the odds of substance use behaviors were greater among individuals who reported non-medical use of prescription opioids. Even with the tightened restrictions on opioid prescriptions that we've had in recent years, do you feel some physicians are still over-prescribing opioids to youth?
Yes, so I've been in practice I'll be starting my 24th year. Things have definitely changed. It used to be that somebody they'd go to urgent care and they'd get anti-inflammatories and some Percocet or Vicodin for something that literally in 10 minutes was 80 or 90% better in my office. So I'm seeing that less and less over the years, but we still use them too often. And I think part of that is because we're seeking the wrong approach. And I was on a provider advisory panel for Optum, which is a subsidiary of United Healthcare, for quite a few years. And I saw a lot of their data, and they had some really interesting data because they have a huge group of people to look at and their behaviors. And there was a distinct lowered risk of an opioid prescription, and not just in what Optum had published, but in other studies, we've seen that seeing a chiropractor reduces overall prescription use, but also specifically opioid use. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting about the Optum study is that that use was durable. So even 10 years later, those people who had seen a chiropractor for back pain were less likely to be using opioids, like 10 years later. But I think it's because they now realize that hey, I was hurt before and it worked. I'm going to go back there again rather than going to urgent care or emergency room setting. My patient that was in yesterday, I just explained, he was clearly emergency room material, but I explained to him, I'm like, you know what? There's not a whole lot of options for what they're going to give you there. It's just going to be higher pain management. We actually, he had a TENS unit at home, which is an electronic device. Mm-hmm. Looks like a Walkman for those of you old enough to remember. And so I gave him instructions on how to use it in the settings. He sent me a picture. We got it, and that was actually providing quite a bit of relief. And today he was feeling better. He's not an emergency room visit candidate, but he was yesterday, and we were able to avoid even an urgent care visit. And he's going to do well. But what ends up happening is a lot of times they'll go there, and still the tools that they have in urgent care and emergency room visits are still generally anti-inflammatories, cyclobenzaprine, so like a generic muscle relaxer. And if strong enough, they'll look at things like opioids. Hydrocodone is still not unusual. And I would be deluded into thinking that I fix everybody that comes through the office. We do occasionally have patients that I just can't help. Either they're in too much pain or something, or they just need more pain control. But those numbers are far smaller if they're filtered first through a chiropractic office. And I've got primary care doctors and pain management doctors that I have a good relationship with, and that we can get those needs filled quickly if need be.
If a child, an adolescent, a teen, a preteen, is prescribed opioid painkillers for a sports injury, a surgery, a dental procedure, what are the steps you suggest to the parent of that child to keep them safe?
So first and foremost, obviously, looking from that study you quoted, like 80% of them have been given a prescription for opioids in the past. Like that needs to be, it's a very rare scenario that any child would need opioids for a musculoskeletal issue. I'm not saying that there aren't any, mm-hmm. but in general, those needs are pretty small. If somehow we need to make sure that we dispose of them afterwards so that they're not in the household. Because having them sitting in the cabinet, I know a lot of people have, the prescription, that old prescription bottle.
Yep.
And we need to dispose of them. We always, both the DEA and local authorities, have frequent drug take back days and great opportunity to get those drugs out of the household so that they don't have access to them. And if not them, bringing it to a friend or a scenario or a party or something where they can be used.
And I would add on top of that, for our listeners in Arizona, if you don't know where a take-back location is near you, dumpthedrugsaz.org. Once again, so that's dumpthedrugsaz.org. We'll bring back a map of permanent drug take-back locations in the state of Arizona. As we've mentioned previously on the show, if you have unused medications that you don't need and you're going to be disposing of, you can find a take-back location. Do not throw out whole pills in the trash. People will retrieve them from the trash if they know they can get a high off of them. Crush them up and combine them with an undesirable substance like sand, coffee grounds, or kitty litter before disposing of them. And one more thing I would add before we get to the next question. When it comes to the parents out there who are prescribed, whose kids get these prescriptions, parents, please do not let your kids self-administer these. I advise that you hold on to them and you dispense them, making sure that your child is taking them accordingly to the instructions. Because when it comes to opioid painkillers, there's a reason people get addicted to them. It's a very euphoric high when those opioid receptors are activated. It feels good. And someone who is a preteen or teen, who's part of the brain that controls impulsive decision-making or anticipates risk, isn't done developing yet. The thought is often, well, this feels good. Why don't I do more of this? So I would add to that, definitely you hand them out to your kids. A line from your bio page on your website really stood out to me, and I'd like to focus a bit more on it for a moment. The quote from your bio said, "Drugs dominate and lifestyle is pushed to the side." Do you feel that we societally have become too dependent on the so-called quick fix And what are the consequences you see as a result of people foregoing lifestyle changes in favor of solely using medication?
Well, obviously my opinion is biased, but it's also biased by reading literally thousands of medical journal articles over the years. We are a drug-dominated society. And I think that that also, so my son is 16 and he's had very little interactions with anything over the years. And he knows that if something's wrong, the beauty of having a chiropractor as a dad, I remember one time they had gone first swimming episode of the summer. He was out playing with his friends all day in the pool and dehydrated. And that night woke up in the middle of the night with agonizing headache. Crying. I want to say he was probably about six or so. So hopped into bed with him. Luckily, knowing what to do, I was able to calm the muscles down and back off his headache to where he fell asleep. So he's raised with this idea that we rarely turn to a drug unless it's absolutely needed. We have so many households in society, in today's society, that if you open the cabinet drawer, it's like that's our go-to answer. If we have high blood pressure, we're just going to take a medication. We're not going to address the lifestyle that's creating it. Cardiovascular disease is almost entirely preventable.
Yep.
And yet it still remains the number one killer. Even today, in today's high viral times, it's still the number one killer. And it's largely preventable, but we don't make the changes to do that because we think, oh, well, I'm on Lipitor or atorvastatin, and that will help lower my risk. And it really doesn't change the trajectory. Otherwise, we wouldn't have cardiovascular disease being the number one killer. It would work. Instead, it doesn't because we're not using the lifestyle choices that we need to do. And that is, I think it's bleeding down into our kids. So our kids think that that's the answer. Like if a pill fixes mom and dad and grandma and grandpa, then well, it should be okay. It's a prescription. It should be fine. And that's the unfortunate place that we're at in society. We've just been bred that there's an answer to that in a pill.
And that's part of the reason why a lot of the kids that we meet in the work that we do at Not My Kid have a low perception of risk when it comes to prescription drug misuse, because they see their parents take these, they see their grandparents take these. They're growing up in a society where there's pharmaceutical commercials on TV pretty frequently now, and they look to us, they look to adults, they look to the adults in their lives, their parents, their grandparents, etc. And if they see us turning to a medication rather than addressing the root cause, we're setting that standard for them. Speaking of lifestyle changes, what are the main areas of lifestyle changes? And I know that for me, diet and exercise come to mind first. What are the main types of lifestyle changes you feel can benefit the physical, mental, and emotional health of adolescents growing up in this era? You mentioned you have a 16-year-old son. What do we as parents need to focus on helping them learn, understand, or maybe change?
You're absolutely right about physical fitness. We do, and we live in a state where access to things like hiking, like being outside, Mother Nature is just fantastic for us across the board. Not only physical activity, you've got fresh air, you've got sunlight, and just mentally, we're different. I usually say, like, you pass by somebody at the gym and you say hi, and you're like, if you get a grunted in reply. And yet, if you're out hiking and you say good morning, it's likely that somebody's going to say good morning back. It's a different mental state. So, of course, in August, that's a little bit more of a challenge, but we certainly need to move. And that's first and foremost. As far as diet goes, just, it's inherent. Avoiding the processed foods. And I have what I call the 8-year-old rule. If the 8-year-old rule, if the typical 8-year-old can't read the ingredients label, we probably shouldn't be eating it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the foods we have now don't pass the 35-year-old biochemist rule.
That's true.
Like there's some complicated things on the ingredients label. And so that alone would cut out half of the junk that we're eating. Certainly stress management is a whole different conversation.
Yep.
We have tools like yoga, biofeedback, meditation. There are more and more both cell phone, we now have app. I mean, before I used to have a device called the Respirate that we kept in the office. It was a biofeedback for breathing. And it was a $300 device that had kind of, well, some of these things are accessible easily on your phone. And so there's tools available that are really cool. We have all kinds of breathing exercises and apps. There's no shortage of these tools readily available for free or very inexpensive.
You opened your practice in 1998. That's quite a while ago. Have you seen any changes in the types of challenges people are dealing with more in recent years as our lifestyles have changed a bit, or has it remained largely the same? Are you seeing people dealing with issues that are coming from like an increasingly sedentary lifestyle? Has it changed or has it remained largely the same?
What I've seen, so I'm 52 now and closing in on 53. And what I've seen is, so I practice what I preach. I am still heavily involved in martial arts, have been for 30 plus years. And what I see is my age group is not aging very well. And it's unfortunate that we start losing quality of life when we can't do what we want to do. Some of it's movement, some of it's diet. There was just a study yesterday on how diabetes impact, like really just shortens quality of life and shortens lifespan. Like there's no doubt about it that diabetes is very bad for us. And the earlier somebody gets diabetes, the more devastating it is. So a 30-year-old being diagnosed with type 1 diabetes is going to have far worse outcomes than a 70-year-old being diagnosed. Now, that would be, that kind of makes sense because the longer we're damaging our body. But I think part of it is that we think that if we're diabetic, we'll just take this medication and we'll be fine. And this is just having diabetes. It's not medicated or not medicated. So we think that being medicated, that we high five each other and pat each other in the back and we fix the problem, but we really haven't. So over the course of 20 plus years in practice, I'm continuing to fight the same thing as far as getting people to make the right choices. I do find that different generations have a different approach. So at 52, that puts me at a generation, but my age group is not taking very good care of themselves. And that's the culmination of decades of not taking care of themselves. So the unfortunate thing is that things are not getting better. I do, however, see parents being certain age groups being a little bit more engaged with their kids and making the right choices, keeping them away from medication. Of course, then we're dealing with, I've had to have the conversation with my 16-year-old son about this whole, that marijuana is now the default answer to everything.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so readily accessible and it's going to fix my depression. It's going to, it's not that simple of an answer, and we're just trying to replace that. So I do see that as an issue now that I never saw years ago. But with the increasing acceptance of marijuana, we're also seeing this idea that it can now fix everything. And I worry that we're going to throw everything else back out, the exercise and the healthier fats and things that will help brain health. And we're just going to be a mess. But again, it's back to that quick fix rather than getting the real answers.
We see that a lot too with young people now when it comes to marijuana or THC in a concentrated form. And what they're failing to understand is, like so many other things, like alcohol, street drugs, etc., THC affects their developing brain in such a more damaging way even than the adult brain. But there again, we're looking for another quick fix. It just happens to have shifted to a different area. Tell our listeners a little bit about your YouTube channel, Bogash Life and Balance, which, by the way, we will link to in the show notes for those listening. What's the focal point of your channel, and how often do you tend to update with new videos?
New videos depends on how much time I have, but I probably, depending upon how productive I am, anywhere from 10 to 20 videos per month. I almost always link them. I've got 10 emails in my inbox right now on something I like that article I mentioned about diabetes, like I flag that to make that into a video to educate people so that I make sure that if I'm saying something opposite of what they heard, they can go fact check. That has been the most important thing in today's society is nobody fact checks. They read the headline and the headline doesn't always say what the article actually says. So I have really hung my hat on being able to back up everything that I have to say. And so every video, like 99.9% of the videos I put out have the research article that I'm talking about. Like as you gave earlier, the article in JAMA Pediatrics, now that one was a little bit old, but that idea is that prior to videos, it was, I've written over 4,000 articles. I've got 23 or 24 eBooks, I've got a book on migraines and epilepsy. All of them are just designed to let people know. I always say there's a huge gap between what we know in the research and what happens in a typical doctor's office, specialists included. A lot of times about 20 years. So all of my social media, and I'm across all the channels except TikTok, quite haven't gotten, I'm resisting that one. are all designed to bring the research that I just read into the forefront so that people can actually look at the research and I kind of clarify it and point out the, because that's what we need to do. We need to not listen to the headline or the media. We need to actually read the, and it's not that hard to read research, especially if somebody kind of points out what's important in them.
Definitely. I love it. Bring your sources. Is there anything else you'd like to add or anything I may have overlooked?
No, I think we had a good conversation here and really appreciate the time today. And again, it's just, you know, my passion is always to educate. So any opportunity I get to do that is always exciting for me.
Once again, our guest today has been Dr. James Bogash, author, lifestyle coach, and founder of Life Care Chiropractic. We'll be sure to include links to his website, blog, and YouTube channel in the show notes. Dr. Bogash, thank you again for sharing your time with us and joining us on Win This Year.
Okay, Shane, thank you very much and have a good rest of your day.
As always on Win This Year, we'd like to give you some resources in case you are facing a mental or behavioral health challenge or you're helping someone who is. You can reach the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline by calling 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK, T-A-L-K. The crisis text line can be reached by texting the word LISTEN to 741-741. Community information and referral services are available by dialing 211 or visiting 211.org. And the Not My Kid text line can be reached by texting the word QUESTION to area code 602-580-0665. Once again, text the word QUESTION to area code 602-580-0665. Thanks once again to our guest, Dr. James Bogash. If you've enjoyed this episode, if you enjoy Win This Year, please be sure to subscribe, share, and spread the word. Win This Year can be found on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and nearly every other mainstream podcast outlet. If you have questions or concerns, would like to suggest a guest or a topic for a future episode, email us at winthisyear@notmykid.org. As always, all links mentioned in this episode will be in the show notes, along with all the links for Not My Kid's social media. I'm Shane Watson, Public Information Officer and Prevention Specialist for Not My Kid. Thank you again for listening to Win This Year.